Yeah, they're coming for that. Senator Johnson, would you like to move?
Oh, I sure would. I move Senate File 1057.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senate File 1057 is Governor Dayton's Jobs and Economic Development Bill. Minnesota's job growth in 2012 was the 12th best among 50 states. We outperformed Iowa, South Dakota, and Wisconsin. Only North Dakota did better in the upper Midwest, and they led the nation. Our economy is improving, but we can do better. We need to be competitive, and this bill provides some additional effective tools to help us attract businesses, retain jobs, and compete in the 21st century global economy.
Madam Chair, I don't know if we need to adopt the amendment beforehand, or
do you have an amendment, ma'am?
We have the A4 amendment. We can do that.
I would move A4 amendment to Senate File 1057.
Okay, Senator Johnson moves the A4 amendment. Is there any discussion?
I will get into the amendment shortly.
Okay, then we'll wait.
Thank you.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Oh,
yep,
I was going to say, do we have the A4 amendment?
I do, but that may be because I'm chairing.
Do others have the A4? Okay. Maybe if staff
okay.
can get that.
This
Senator
bill,
Dietzick.
Thank you. This bill increases funding for the Minnesota Investment Fund, establishes a Minnesota Job Creation Fund, and supports a global competitiveness initiative. It also streamlines some construction inspections and reduces the unemployment insurance tax for employers. We handed out a handout that goes over the Minnesota Investment Fund, the Job Creation Fund, and the Global Competitive Initiative. In short, the bill will provide $30 million for the Minnesota Investment Fund. And many states offer huge incentives to attract businesses to their state. Minnesota offers only modest incentives. So this bill increases funding for Minnesota Investment Fund that provides financing to create and retain quality jobs. It helps encourage local firms that have options outside of the state to expand here and provides incentives for firms outside of Minnesota to locate to our state. It provides $25 million for the Minnesota Job Creation Fund. This fund will provide additional funding with targeted, strategic incentives to retain and attract jobs. It replaces the JOBS, J-O-B-Z program. It's more transparent and accountable. The two funds will help level the playing field and help keep and attract jobs in our communities. The bill also includes $1.5 million for the Global Competitiveness Initiative. This initiative will establish 3 new trade offices in foreign markets. 37 states have overseas trade offices. We have one in Shanghai, and we've seen a 71% increase in exports to China since it opened in 2005. It will also help qualifying small businesses participate in trade activities by offering financial and technical assistance and communicate the benefits of doing business in Minnesota. So that's a short summary of the office, or of the bill. I have Kim Babine, Legislative Affairs for the Department of Employment and Economic Development, here with me to answer any specific questions. And we also have Ed Dieter from the Trade Office and Kenan McKinnon from the Business Development Office. So the A4 amendment, it kind of provides more detail for the additional trade offices. Subdivision 1 sets a deadline to establish the trade office by July 1st, 2014. Subdivision 2 refers to the duties assigned to the Commissioner for Trade Promotion in current statute. Subdivision 3 adds some discretionary powers. Subdivision 4 allows staff to be employed by the trade offices. And Subdivision 5 requires the Commissioner to establish goals for the office and requires a report to the legislature every other year detailing performance of the office. I'd like to thank Stephanie James and everyone at Deed who worked over the weekend to help prepare for today. Ann, are there any questions on the amendment or the bill?
Members, are there questions? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dietzick, 3 new trade offices to be put in place. How are they going to be funded?
Senator Dietzick.
I will have Kim Babine answer that one.
Please identify yourself.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Kim Babine. I am the Director of Legislative Affairs at the department. The offices are, the bill that's before you is the budget bill that covers the department as well as some others. So there's an appropriation for it, for the offices to be expanded. It was also a governor's recommendation. So it requires an appropriation from the general fund.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Ms. Boebein, that means that we will probably be having to look for appropriate revenue sources to increase the budget for DEED. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, there isn't a direct tie to a revenue raiser and this budget item. It would be considered in the grand scope or the scope of the grand budget in terms of the balance between revenues and the finance budget items.
So, Madam Chair, according to the bill's title, it says we're going to be creating the fund and then increasing certain fees for the purposes of putting these requirements into law. So I guess that means that we're going to have to find some way to raise money.
Members, to be clear, the bill before you includes the budgets for also the Department of Labor, which is where those fees specifically are. There are no fees within the Department of Employment and Economic Development's budget that would be raised, but there are those are you're referring to the larger budget.
Well, Madam Chair, Ms. Boebein, we are going to be putting three new trade offices in place, so to create three new trade offices, you're going to have extra funds to make that happen.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I believe that's where the $1.5 million, part of that $1.5 million that's appropriated to the Global Initiative will help set up those trade offices.
Madam Chair, and testifier, what would be the spending increases over the 2012-13? How much of a percentage increase is that? Madam Chair, could we ask Senator Desick to maybe use a different microphone, or is it just my ears?
No,
I'm having a hard time understanding her.
Just don't get too close.
Okay. I know some of you can't hear. Is that better?
And I'm old.
Yeah. Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, are you referring specifically to the percent change in the Minnesota Trade Office or the deeds budget overall?
Deed budget.
The deed budget overall. I'll need just a moment, Senator and Madam Chair, to find that in my budget pages as I was more prepared for the policy aspect today. Just a moment.
Thank you.
Madam Chair,
there's got to be parts in here that are
paid by. I don't have the specific percent change, Senator. I have from our total fiscal year 14-15 budget is $869,122. Unfortunately, I don't have the 13-14 or the 12-13 budget in front of me.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I'm wondering what part of this is in our purview, because we really don't talk about, in this committee, the financing of it, right? I mean, there must be just sections in here that we should be looking at.
Thank you. Senator Scalzi, could you address that, please? Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, the portion of this bill that's within the jurisdiction of this committee is the establishment of the trade offices as new executive branch agencies. And in the original bill, it's, as introduced, page 25, beginning at line 15. What the A4 amendment does is replace section 4 with the new section 4 that's in the amendment. Also within the jurisdiction of this committee is the repeal of the Minnesota Science and Technology Authority. That's in Article 5, lines 28.33 through 29.4.
What page is that?
The second one is on page 28, line 33, through page 29, line 4.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the amendment that's before us, it says staff may each office may employ staff necessary to carry out the office's duties. How many FTEs are expected to staff these three new offices, Ms. Bavine?
Ms. Bavine.
Within the budget bill, there are two FTEs that are being accounted for to be able, and I'm actually going to pause there and call up the acting director of the trade office, Ed Dieter, to help answer some questions on that specifically.
Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Edward Dieter, and I'm deputy director of the trade office.
Thank you, Mr. Dieter.
Madam Chair and members, the question about the number of employees necessary for the overseas trade offices, we would be looking at doing these in a variety of different ways, either on a contractual basis with people who are local, or in the case of being able to have actual employees and offices there. I think the purpose of this section is to make it possible for us to hire employees.
Thank you, Mr. Dieter. Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Mr. Dieter, so how many anticipated FTEs are you planning to be able to make these three offices work? I mean, you're saying you're going to have some flexibility, but what's your anticipation of making those three offices work with three FTEs, four FTEs? Just kind of a ballpark figure if you got something off.
Commissioner.
Yes, Madam Chair and members. Well, for example, in the office in Shanghai today, we contract with them. The office itself has about 10 to 12 employees, but we work with them on more of an as-needed basis. It probably totals something less than one FTE per year. And so we would expect that for these overseas offices, we would in the neighborhood of about one FTE per office.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, Senator Johnson. Oh, sorry, no. Senator Scalzi. Senator Johnson will renew her.
Move, 1057, House, Senate File 1057 as amended.
We have to adopt the amendment first, okay. Senator Johnson.
Okay, now I'll remove the A4 amendment, Madam
Thank
Chair.
Thank you,
sir. Madam Chair?
Yes.
Could I have a roll call?
Roll call has been asked for.
Madam Chair.
Sarah Peterson.
Are we taking, as I understand it, we're just moving the author's amendment here?
8-4.
No, roll call on a bill, please.
That's what I thought, Senator Anderson, man. I just want to, we don't, our intention, I don't think, is to roll call the author's amendment.
Okay. Oh, okay. I thought we had passed it already.
My mistake.
Okay, so we're starting with, I'm
the A4 amendment.
Here, the A4 author's amendment. Okay, so the roll call has been withdrawn?
Yes, it's
okay,
only on.
No roll call. Any more discussion on the A4 amendment? This was the author's amendment, so we're accepting it, I assume. All right, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. All right, Senator Dietzick.
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we've had a summary of the, at least the portion of the bill that this committee deals with, and so I think it's a good bill. It will help, like I said earlier, level the playing field to help keep businesses here and bring more businesses here, and so I ask for your support.
Already discussed. Are you doing this? You already discussed my jurisdiction.
Yeah.
All right. So there any more discussion, Senator Johnson?
No, I shouldn't say no. I would move Senate File 1057 as amended be recommended to pass.
And this is where we want the roll call,
roll call
Senator
please.
Anderson. Senator Peterson.
I just have a question on the bill.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dietzick. Looking at your graphic here, titled Supporting Business and Job Creation, Minnesota Investment Fund. Is there any more information that's provided here regarding some of the metrics or statistics that you have here? For example, on jobs retained, jobs created statewide, and some of the methodology and as to how that's calculated.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, I would like to call Kevin McKinnon, who's the Director of Business and Community Development at DEED, who can help provide some context around that information.
Can you just say your name for the tape, please?
Kevin McKinnon.
McKinnon?
Kevin McKinnon, yep. Executive Director of Business and Community Development at DEED.
Repeat the question, please.
Madam Chair, Mr. Executive Director, sorry, I forgot your name there.
McKinnon.
Mr. McHenry. My question was, do you have some information on how we arrived at the jobs retained and jobs created through the Minnesota Investment Fund? I see you've got some statistics here that say for every $1 invested, there's a certain return in jobs. I'm just interested to hear about the methodology and coming to those conclusions.
Mr. McKinnon.
Madam Chair, members, with every project that comes before us, and particularly in the Minnesota Investment Fund, there's a variety of pieces that are brought together to the table from financing, from local contributions and others. And so when we put all the projects together, and particularly an individual project, there's obviously certain leverage. Other funds that are brought to the table, what the private business puts in, what the other sources of financing might be, those types of things. That's how we come up with the amount, and certainly the amount per dollar awarded by the Minnesota Investment Fund. As far as the jobs go, yes, the companies must commit to a certain number of jobs over a two-year period. We ultimately go out and monitor that and make sure that they have performed and done what they said they were going to do. They also, in some situations, are very competitive situations where we are trying to attract and retain employees. So in addition to some of the new jobs that are created, which this fund always requires, we also are able to ascertain how many people are being retained as well.
Are there any more questions? Okay, seeing none, then Senator Johnson moves that Senate File 1057 is amended to be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance. And a roll call was requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Pappas?
Yes.
Eaton?
Yes.
Hall?
No.
Anderson?
No.
Dahl?
Yes.
Hayden? Housley?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Peterson?
No.
Scalzi?
Yes.
Thompson?
No.
Torres Ray?
Yes.
Wicklund?
Yes.
There being seven in favor and five opposed, the motion prevails, and the bill is passed and is title agreed to. Sorry, I couldn't resist. All right. Senate File 1057 is on its way to finance. Senator Franzen? Senate File 1414. Funny to me. Sorry, Franz. I'm sorry, I'm just laughing at my joke that no one else laughed at, but I thought it was funny.
I missed it.
I'm glad you're not laughing.
On the floor, we say the bill is passed and its title agreed to. That's the thing we say when we pass a bill on the floor. So it's in my brain. Senator Franzen, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. Senate File 1414 is a bill fundamentally about transparency and process. Some members may recall, particularly those who are Metro City, represent some of the Metro Cities, that last fall the Minnesota Airport Commission, or MAC, in coordination with the Federal Aviation Administration, held public meetings to entertain various proposals that would significantly alter the flight patterns in and out of Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. Due to the adoption of new technology where flight paths would be consolidated into two tracks. Some meetings were held within the various affected communities, while the official MAC board meeting was ultimately where the decision would be made occurred within the Minneapolis-St. Paul airport facility. And this meant that any member of the community would have to enter through airport security and present personal identification in order to enter the premises and otherwise enter a public meeting. And this process not only presents inconveniences to some members of the public, but also hinders the transparency of the public policy process. And what was at stake in that meeting was significant, and this was the forum where only some community members, that was the only forum that they were able to attend and raise concerns about changes that would happen that would have a significant impact to their property and their noise impact in their community and their home. So if you've seen that in the news, I won't elaborate unless people have questions, members have questions. But basically, it was a packed room, no overflow, and to some members of the community, they were quite concerned that this would the proposed package of or changes that were going to be happening were essentially have a superhighway over their household. So there was a lot of questions, a lot of angst in a very short period of time. So this bill aims to restore the public trust in the process by changing the venue of similar meetings of public interest. And the bill basically defines public interest as a meeting that has broad public interest if 30 or more people are expected to attend. So it doesn't really impact the normal operations of the MAC board, just in cases where there's meetings of significant broad public interest, that there would be a different venue so people would have access to what's at stake in that meeting. So I understand the MAC board has met in other venues before, so this should not be an unreasonable request if the MAC board deems a meeting of broad public interest, and it shouldn't also be have any undue burden on the ability to confirm with this request because it would be just limited to certain meetings, not all. If anybody has any members have any questions, I stand for questions, but there is also a testifier from the MAC board that would also like some time to present.
Any questions for Senator Franson? Then Mr. Killian. Mr. Killian, is the commission's, I don't know what you want to call it, headquarters in the airport property itself?
Madam Chair and members of the State and Local Government Committee, Mitch Killian with the Metropolitan Airports Commission. Our general offices are located on the backside of the airport, but what we see as our kind of our city hall or our commission chambers, which very much resembles Minneapolis and St. Paul type commission chambers, is inside of the terminal building where people do have to come through security. And I'm happy to give you a little bit of background on our operation if I can.
Please, go ahead.
Thank you. First of all, we've had a very good meeting with Senator Franz and understand her concern and look forward to keeping trying to work through those concerns. The bill does have some political and logistical and possibly open meeting law challenges for us, none that are insurmountable, so we think we can work through it. But we didn't want to miss this opportunity to have you understand us a little bit better and how the place kind of works and that. When you do come to a commission meeting as a general member of the public, you park in our parking ramps. You go down to an information booth. You have to show your ID to get cleared for the no-fly list. It takes just a minute down there. They check your ID, check you against the no-fly list, hand your ID right back to you, no real database or anything. And then you proceed up to the employee checkpoint, which usually has a couple of people in the line. And then you go up to our commission chambers, which is like a city hall and is part of a conference center that's inside the terminal building. The whole process, I've interviewed several people that come to our meetings regularly from the public. It takes about 10 minutes or so. They've said to me, on a bad day, if you catch TSA at the wrong time, it can be 15 minutes or so. Some of those people actually say they prefer it there because of inclement weather, parking in the ramps and other things. But the fact is that you do have to show an ID, and you do have to go through security, and we understand that. But the going through security is not unprecedented in that there are other local units of government that have you pass through security to get to the commission meetings. A couple of pieces, though, that we wanted you to make sure you understand is the commission meets about 48 times a year in committees and commission meeting processes. Frequently, the agenda looks a lot like a city council meeting in that it's businesses doing business with the airport, escalator, cleaning contracts, leasing agreements, things like that. We operate a lot like a city council in that we swear in police officers because we have our full-time police department. And then the usual kind of rituals of getting awards and giving awards and things like that that happen in a city council. And that's what happens in our commission chambers. 48 meetings a year. Every 3 or 4 years, we have one of these big flare-ups, and they oftentimes, or almost most of the time since I've been there, are concerned around airplane noise. And the last one did have 230 people attend it, and they did have to go through that process. But I want to make sure you understand a little bit about our noise process and the input that we take on noise in general. One piece is that besides the full commission, everything that goes to the full commission body goes through a committee and is heard in a committee level. Below that, we have a group called the Noise Oversight Committee, which is made up of community citizens are appointed by the cities, and they meet with the airline operators on the airport to discuss noise issues. And as much as you might think that it's just kind of where should the noise going, there's lots of technical aspects of noise, and they meet monthly. And there are city council people appointed from Bloomington and Minneapolis and Richfield that sit and meet on these issues. Those meetings don't take place behind security. They're over in our general offices, and public often attends those. And there's lots of input for public at those meetings.
Is that a separate location from the airport?
That's correct. That's held in our general offices.
Oh, you do have offices outside the airport?
Yes. The MAC general office is on the back side of the airport on 34th Avenue.
And you don't have to enter through the airport?
That's correct.
To get there. I see. And there's a meeting room there?
Yes.
Okay.
So the Noise Oversight Committee meets, but in addition to that, we actually have quarterly input meetings in the evening again, where we actually call it like open mic night, where the staff goes out and presents on noise issues and gives them updates on issues and lets the citizens all give input into what's been going on noise in their communities, that we take dialogue that way. On the process that was kind of addressed earlier, the departure procedures, our RNAV procedures that occurred, prior to that final MAC meeting, we actually met in a church basement in Minneapolis where over 100 people attended. We met in the Egan Community Center where over 200 people attended and gave input in kind of an open house setting with commissioners and staff, and we took public input. Now, this we really approach with caution because we don't want to be so defensive about not being open to public, mm-hmm. and we're here to work with Senator Franzen and her community on the concerns, but we just didn't want to leave this without the members knowing that there's lots of public input on airplane noise and on other issues as well that work up in a process that eventually does go to the commission where that final vote is taken. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To just go into the airport and go through the screening process is really difficult, and parking is a problem. So I just have to say that up front because I do that a lot. And if I drive my car, it is a problem versus taking a cab. But how many people do you usually house in your MAC general offices on 34th Avenue?
Mr. Killian.
Representative Scalzi, Chairwoman Pappas, I think that your question is it how many people are officed there? What right. percentage of the MAC staff is officed there?
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. How many people are actually staffed there? I don't know. Are they staffed other places other than your MAC general offices? I'm trying to get at how many people can fit into that facility.
Mr. Killian.
Senator Pappas and Senator Scalzi. There are conference rooms there, but they definitely are not set up like a commission chambers or as big a location to hold 270 people that come and things. Even with the parking situation, when you add staff and other issues, you're going to be parking blocks kind of away. It's not perfect setup for large meetings like that. There are conference rooms there, and that's why the Noise Oversight Committee, and we do hold other meetings there. The bottom line is, if we wanted to use that facilities as our town hall, we probably could. It's going to take some major retrofitting and some changing to make it a real commission chambers to address the business that you've put before us and the communities do and things. But it certainly could, so we don't want to do that. But a lot of the business that I'm trying to get is about the airport terminal itself. And today I just came from a commission meeting, and it was an award. It was in a lease with OTG, which is a vendor in the terminal building. It's important for us even to have those 15 members that are appointed to be on this board to be there to part of that city hall and that city chambers that's in the commission meeting, to have them just show up for their monthly meetings over in the business offices on the back side would be a bit of a disservice. But I approach with caution because we really are here to say we want to figure out how to be as open during these really difficult public discussions, often on airplane noise, as we can. But that general business at hand of day in and day out, I don't have a... it really is about that terminal building and lots of things that are happening, ribbon cuttings and the commissioners being part of it and all the things a business does as a business-type board that takes place in that terminal building.
How many people in your commission chambers, how many members of the public can fit there? What's the capacity?
Chairwoman Pappas, that particular day, I think there were, well, there were 230 general public people, and then the 15-member board plus staff, I'd estimate 250 to 270.
Oh, so it's a very large
that made it chambers. Into that meeting location that day.
Okay. So you have three options, basically, for meetings. You have the commission chambers, which is within the security part of the airport. You have your general offices, which are outside the security of the airport, and people can just come without ID, but that's limited to maybe 20, 30 people in the conference rooms.
I don't want to overstate that. It's bigger than that.
Okay, it's a little bit bigger than that, up to 50 maybe in the conference rooms. And then the other option you have for public meetings is you would just use a community facility, a community center or a church basement or something.
Senator Pappas, that's absolutely correct. In fact, we've met in Washburn High School. We've met in the Thunderbird Hotel on different issues. But the one thing on noise you got to watch out for is when we're trying to pick those locations on that last RNAV issue, Richfield had a completely different position than Minneapolis and Edina. And so when you start picking your locations, when you're talking about airplane noise, you could run into a situation where people's perception is that you're favoring a location. And so we'd have to find a neutral location and things. And we have a public hearing coming up on our environmental assessment, and we definitely are meeting outside in the evening to make sure and take public input when we can.
And Senator Franson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd like to highlight, because I was there for that meeting where we had more than 200 community members in attendance, and the room was packed to the maximum capacity. Probably, if firefighters came in, probably we'd probably been overpacked, I would imagine. We were sitting, it was just too many people, and we were expecting that to be such because of the nature of the issue. And I didn't go into the details of RNAV, and that's the technology that we were talking about. So that's very technical and obviously a new technology that a lot of people had a lot of interest to know how that's going to impact, whether it's going to be having airplanes coming through on top of my house every 10 seconds, 5 seconds. I mean, that's the magnitude of this issue. So we were anticipating a lot of people to be in attendance, and it was pretty smooth to go through security. But once we were there, it was just so packed that it just seemed like we were expecting that to happen, and we want to make sure that people have access to the process. It's not about what the issue it is, because today's RNAV, tomorrow it could be something else that impacts your community. And to have, in those particular instances, when we need people to be as clear and have access to the process as possible, either to have an overflow, that wasn't the case. I mean, people were just standing up. We had Mayor Ryback, Mayor Hovland, of all these communities that were interested. We were all just standing up.
But with that huge number of people, were there long lines then waiting to go through security to get into the chambers?
Madam Chair, I did go a little bit early, so there were lines to go through, not just security, but the information booth is where you first go to present your ID, get signed off, and get your reimbursement for your parking. I mean, it's a smooth operation, but with the magnitude of people that were expected, I imagine it was it probably clogged after I left, because there was a lot of people that were coming through.
So, Mr. Killian, was that kind of a situation where maybe you should have met, you know, somewhere else? Would they ever had a bigger building, a bigger room, or no? Or can you anticipate that?
Thank you, Senator Pappas, and I think that you're absolutely correct in that. That normally, like I say, we do meet in the Thunderbird Hotel. We meet in other locations. There was more than I think you want in your committee today on the RNAV process and how it was condensed down into a 2-month period. And a tight time frame, and some of that was FAA, Federal Aviation Administration, controlled. And so we probably missed the ball on that one. I look in hindsight, we should have tried to get out and make sure that we got out. But there was a real tough decision that had to be made regarding these departure procedures with the federal government to make some certain time lanes for them to do their work to be able to get this implemented for the future. And so those weren't entirely just MAC decisions either about the condensed timeline. That went back to the Noise Oversight Committee with the cities buying into the process and saying, yes, this is the process we want you to follow on that condensed timeline. So had it not been such a tight timeline, we might have been able to adjust our meeting and get out to a neutral site again and make some of those things work. But we probably missed it on that one.
Question, Senator Johnson.
One question, Madam Chair, and I think either one of you, Senator Franson or Mr. Killian, you say a meeting or hearing is of broad public interest if 30 or more persons attend. Now, if you had 10 different items on your agenda, you would likely have 30 people coming in, but not at one time, and there wouldn't be any significant probably issue with it. Is that correct, and has that been addressed anyways?
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Killian.
Chairwoman Pappas. I think the language was written broad intentionally to be to our benefit, to try to give us some leeway on it and things to say, look, you know, depending on, as it was put to me, Jeff Hamill isn't going to be put in handcuffs and carried away if we miss it by a little bit on one. But likely scenario would be is that we would pull the agenda item off and try to find a location for that agenda item and not be part of another agenda and work that out with our commissioners and some of the pieces. But you're right. The average number of people going to our meetings is 6 to 10, and a lot of them are 0 to none.
Senator Hall.
Madam Chair, thank you. How do you know how many people are coming to your meeting?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Killian, do you have an RSVP process?
Well, I thank you for the question. And you don't know for sure, but I think that Senator Franson could tell you we knew on this one.
Senator Franson.
Madam Chair and Senator Hall, this was right after the November election, and my inbox was inundated with emails, hundreds of emails of people that were interested in this and concerned with this proposal. So we knew that we were going to get more than 30 people. That was for sure. We were expecting hundreds.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
So comfortably at your airport headquarters or City Hall spot, how many can you hold comfortably?
Mr. Killian.
Chairwoman Pappas and Senator Hall, I'm sorry I didn't come with the exact number. It's a 75 or 100. I'm not exactly sure in that location. But the piece is that I don't want you to think that it just works to just go to any old little meeting spot. You're going to need the audio video. You're going to need the all the different pieces of it. You're still going to need these particular meetings are very contentious. So you need somewhat of a council type chambers, I think it's fair to say, to set up some card tables and just act like it's going to be. Yeah. Maybe one time you might get away with that, but eventually the meeting location is going to have to be retrofitted to kind of meet the decorum that you're looking for from this type of establishment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Franson.
Madam Chair and Senator Hall, don't intend to be taking over the business of running a MAC board and their facilities that they need to run their business. But it is, I would agree, it has to be a setting where it's got to be like a city council setting where you have the same functions you have here with audiovisual and taping and whatnot and potentially have overflow like a city council. And I think most, if not all, our cities have that to date, at least the ones that are that we're talking about and that are directly affected by proposals to the nature of what the MAC board deals with.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
Thank you. I don't know. It seems to me that the commissioner here is responding well to this. You can't always you can't convenience everyone at every place. I mean, I see a lot of people are saying, boy, I wish you guys would have your committee meetings in War Road because we'd like to participate. Well, that's not where it is. We do it here. We try to do best we can. There are times when we have overflow and people actually can't come in. But that's why we try to go back to our districts and have forums or discussions or personal meetings. So I'll be voting no against this.
Madam Chair.
Senator Franson.
Senator Hall, and I respect your decision. I believe this is a pretty interesting case where I don't believe there's any other board meetings to this nature that you actually have to show ID. And correct me if I'm wrong, but not to the extent that you have to go through airport security, go through a background, essentially background checks, making sure you're not on the no-flight zone to just attend a public meeting. So this is a little different, and I completely agree where you're coming from. I just think this one's merits a little bit different approach, and maybe it's not a must, but may look into other options because the facility where we were really didn't work for the public benefit, and I think that's incumbent upon all of us to make sure that we have access to processes and transparency in our decision making. So that's why I'm bringing this to your attention, because this is a unique one.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
Senator, but you don't have may, right? You have must?
I do.
Must.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Franson or Mr. Killian, how many meetings like this do you have where you have your room over? Like Senator Franson just said, you have 230, 250 people in a room on a regular basis.
Mr. Killian.
Mr. Pappas and Senator Anderson, my estimate is that once every 3 to 4 years, if I was to be more conservative, it's once every 2 to 3 years that you have one of these kind of major flare-ups where you get that type of attention. The other time when it fills in, of course, is a police swearing in, because they bring the whole officer group and things like that, where we usually get a large crowd and families and things come. But on these major issues, it's fair to say once every 2 to 3 years, and it might be 3 to 4 years.
That sounds like our Senate hearings.
Any other discussion?
Madam Chair. This.
Senator Wicklund.
I'd just like to say I have heard from constituents in Richfield that it is kind of an extra burden to have to do this, and for meetings like this, I think this is an appropriate way to accommodate the, you know, it is a little more extensive work to go to this public meeting, and we don't do that for anything else that I can think of. So I think it's reasonable to say for large meetings like that to have them do this.
I don't think 30 is really a large meeting. I'm wondering, Senator Franson, if you'd be interested in a higher number than that.
Madam Chair, I certainly would love to work with the MAC board in finding an appropriate number. 30 is a starting point. It's not, it's like must.
Well, this is going from here to the floor, is
correct.
My understanding. I'm also a little concerned about the version that's being considered in the other body.
Madam Chair, and I believe that one, probably have the language with me. They envision all of MAC meetings being outside of the MAC board chambers, and I don't agree with that version. That's not the intent of me bringing this issue to this committee. I think we need to be reasonable, again, back to making sure that the MAC board has the flexibility that they need to conduct their business, and they have their state-of-the-art chamber, so that should be where they sit. This is just for these particular issues, and it might come up. Right now, we just had that one RNAP meeting, but this issue is going to be debated over a longer period of time in the next couple of years, so I envision this to be a bigger issue where we're going to have more than 30. Maybe it's, I don't know, 50 or 100, but I know 240-plus people mm-hmm. in that chamber is just not the right amount to have in that facility.
Well, I think Mr. Killian kind of said that they did blow it with that, and they should have had it in a facility that was larger than that. He did kind of give us a little mea culpa here. What do members think about moving that number up from 30? Senator Johnson?
Madam Chair, and I was going to ask Mr. Killian, first of all, whether you support the bill, because you seem to be very interested in understanding about the purpose of the bill. Do you have a suggestion? What might make this more workable for you?
Mr. Killian.
Senator Pappas and Senator Johnson, I don't think that we can come out and say that we absolutely support it, because there are some logistical and political challenges as we move forward that we're going to bump up against every time, because someone's going to be out there to say you had 31 people and you missed it again, mm-hmm. or there's going to be some other piece of it that we didn't move because we didn't think it was a broad interest, and they came up on with social media. This stuff could pop up 1 hour before the meeting and become a big issue on you and things, and so I'm cautious about supporting it, but we're also not opposed to more public input and figuring out a way to address this, to make sure that we are out on these issues. And we truly want to make sure that everybody has the right amount. But as you know, oftentimes in a public policy process, if someone doesn't get the decision that they want, they're going to show a lot of concern about the process. It's not so much the actual policy outcome, it's the process that comes back to it. And so when we see these types of bills, we're always pretty cautious about leaving ourselves exposed for the next round of debate.
Madam Chair.
Senator Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Johnson, I would be as open as looking what to see what the limit of the capacity of that build of the chamber is or the commission board, and seeing what that number is, and anything that exceeds that, then you have to look for another place, because it was just it was really hard to have the public testimony. It was hard to hear. So anything above and beyond what the capacity of that room is, I think that might be reasonable, because I don't know if we can do an RSVP, or I don't know if that would be something that you'd be open to in the MAC board, commission.
Well, and it seems to me that that's kind of logical language, that if the meeting is expected to exceed the capacity of the chambers, then obviously they should have it somewhere else. I mean, it almost seems silly to put that. It's a lot.
And Madam Chair, and the other piece is, this is a broad public interest issue that we're dealing with, the issue that's currently before the MAC board. It's significant, and for a lot of communities, they still don't understand it. Mm-hmm. So to hide it behind, and I use hide loosely, behind airport security to be able to get information that mm-hmm. needs to be readily available. I have to commend the commission, because we have done some public outreach. I agree that it wasn't perfect, so that's why I'm pushing this forward. But I do want to make sure that we don't just repeat what happened this last November, and that we find a way to make it better and potentially fix it. So maybe that's why the commission doesn't maybe support the bill or can't publicly support the bill, but I know that they know that we need to work on it.
You could say may be held outside or are encouraged to be held outside. I mean, it's kind of sending a message from the legislature without being so prescriptive. And you could say 100 or 200 or more persons. You said the capacity is about 230?
Yeah, it's chambers. I'm not sure what the actual fire code capacity would be, but at the 230 mark, we were overflowing.
Madam Chair?
Yes, yeah, so we could say.
I had been thinking.
You're thinking about it, Senator Johnson?
Myself, and I thought maybe you must attempt to hold the meeting outside of the. But that's kind of like may or encourage you to.
Senate counsel informs me that we do encourage things. So we could say is encouraged to be held. And then what about the number?
Madam Chair?
Senator Eaton.
Chair, could we say something like the capacity of the facility?
Well, we did. I just think it's like, I've suggested that, but I think that's so obvious. If it's going to exceed the capacity of the facility, obviously they shouldn't have it in the facility. So that's why I thought we should put a number below the capacity.
Okay.
Which we think might be like around 200 or maybe lower, 150. I'm open. We have to decide. Senator Peterson.
Madam Chair, and I would propose.
Senator Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe not going so off the initial target. I'd be comfortable with 100.
With 100.
And then we can always have the discussion, make sure that.
That seems like a big turnout to me, 100. I don't have that many people come to my town meetings. So, Senator Peterson, do you want to join this discussion?
Not really, but because it's gone on for so long.
I know it has. Let's just move it.
Madam Chair, I was just going to say, you know, I'm sure Senator Franson has spent a lot more time than every single one of us combined on this issue to come to 30. I'm willing to trust her judgment. Mm-hmm. I'd be willing to move Senate file 1414 if we could. I don't think necessarily we're going to take the issue any more seriously than the author has in preparing for committee, and we can get on to the rest of the bills here on the calendar.
Well, Senator Peterson, I think we're discussing an amendment first. No one has offered an amendment.
I would move, Madam Chair.
All right. Senator Johnson.
I would move that we delete 30 on line 12 and insert 100.
Okay. Do you want to include in your amendment to delete must and put are encouraged to?
Yes.
Okay. So Senator Johnson.
I'm okay with Senator Franson.
Okay, Senator Johnson moves that on line 1.9 delete must and insert are encouraged to, and on 1.112 delete 30 and insert 100. All those in favor of that amendment say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. All right, then.
I would move recommend Senate File 1414 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
All those in favor of that motion say aye.
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 Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. All right. Spend so much time on the right. Senator.
I don't think she was.
Yes. People think this is easy. Senator Clausen.
Yes, then. You guys, the jobs finance bill. Spend 20 minutes on this thing.
Senator Clausen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Do you have an A3 amendment?
I do, and for the record, my name is Greg Clausen. I'm a member of the Minnesota Senate, and I believe you have a copy of the author's A3 amendment. It clarifies language and adds some specificity to the task force requirements that are outlined in Senate File 410.
So this is not an author's amendment. It's your second committee, but this is reworking the task force to comply with, I think, probably our guidelines. Is that right, Ms. James? Okay. She's nodding her head.
I'm sure, yes.
Do you want to just tell us a little bit about the task force, and then was Ms. Munyon, were you just here to testify or just as a resource?
If I'm needed.
Okay. Senator Clausen.
Very good. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here with you today. And we are asking for your support in Senate File 410. It's a proposal which directs the Commissioner of Education to adopt standards and rules for a statewide adult high school diploma to be earned through local adult basic education programs. And those adult basic education programs are commonly known as ABE programs. Adult basic education programs are administered primarily through local community education programs. ABE provides programming in a number of areas, including General Education Development Diploma, or the GED, adult diploma, basic skills enhancement, workplace literacy, English as a second language, family literacy, and courses in citizenship and civics. Nearly all ABE clients are low income, and last year over 73,000 adults were enrolled. There are five main points to consider regarding the adult high school diploma. First, currently there are no standardized adult diplomas in Minnesota, although there are some that are offered through adult basic education programs. Some ABE programs do offer programs, but because there's no statewide standards, not all educational institutions or employers will recognize a diploma. Many employers and educational institutions no longer accept the GED, and the military has capped the number of GED graduates that they will accept. The General Education Development Test was recently acquired by a new company and has increased the cost of taking the test, which may be beyond the affordability of many low-income adults. Currently, the cost is $100, but there are some states where it's over $400 at this time. And I think it's important to look a little bit at the history of the GED. It was established following World War II because of the volume of servicemen that were returning from the war. Many of them had their education cut short by enlisting, and there were also at that time many males and females that quit their education to go into the workforce. So the general education diploma served a purpose, and after, 50, 60 years, maybe it's time to look at a change. And then lastly, the point I'd like to make is that for many AB learners, a standardized test alone may not be a good way to measure skills. A standardized adult diploma would provide learners with an alternative. If you look at Section 2 of the bill, it directs the Commissioner of Education to adopt guidelines after considering recommendations from an advisory task force establishing a standard adult Minnesota high school diploma. Senate File 410 will allow adult competencies to ensure post-secondary programs, institutions, and potential employers that a person holding a standard high school diploma and persons holding an adult high school diploma are equally prepared and qualified graduates. A 2012 task force sponsored by the Minnesota Department of Education and the Literacy Action Network explored the need for and recommended an adult high school diploma be made available. And Senate File 410 and House File 477, if adopted, will implement the task force recommendations. At this time, I'd like you to hear from Sherry Munyon, representing the Literacy Action Network.
Ms. Munyon, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, Sherry Munyon representing the Literacy Action Network today. And we are here specifically to create the task force. The task force, as you heard, is a result of the work done at MDE last year. And the stage that we're at today is we need the task force to actually make specific recommendations on how to implement an adult diploma to the commissioner. And then it would be up to the commissioner to accept that recommendation, and local districts would then issue diplomas that meet those standards.
Okay, are there any questions? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Clausen or Ms. Munyon, there's mention in testimony that the military is capping the number of GED students being allowed into the military. What is your perception of an adult or the requirements for an adult high school diploma to allow more people to get into the military if they wanted to through this program?
Senator Clausen.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Anderson. I think what the military has done, because the GED lacks the standards that are really necessary, they're looking at capping the number that they will allow at any given time or any given year in the military. I think what the Senate File 410 does, it establishes rigorous standards, provides for very specific requirements for adults to pass this assessment.
Okay, are there any more questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Ms. Munyon, were you a part of the task force that looked at establishing these rigorous standards in 2012, and what were some of the examples of standards that would make this a much better diploma?
Ms. Munyon.
Madam Chairman, Senator, no, I was not a part of the task force, and our witness wasn't able to be here this afternoon. But in taking a look at what some alternatives to the GED are because of costs and other inhibiting factors, there is a strong focus on work readiness skills that will be included here, personal and professional success skills, and academic skills. So this isn't a dumbing down, but this is just an alternative way for people to become employed. We have many districts who work with their work readiness programs through the ABE programs and local employers and establish certificates. So, for instance, in Southwest Minnesota, Marshall, their ABE program worked with the Workforce Center and with the employer, where the employer had a need for welders, but there were no qualified individuals in the community, and they established a training program there that made them work ready.
So, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Anderson.
Ms. Munyon, what is the projection, or what, if you know any, or Senator Clausen, do you know how many do you expect to add to the workforce or add to those looking for people that are qualified? Do you have any projection of percentage, 10%, 5%, 15%?
Ms. Munyon.
Madam Chair, Senator, I do not have a projection, but we have seen a steady growth. Last year, the participants who completed their educational level and were ready for workforce was 48%. 5 years before that, it was 36%. and 10 years ago it was 21%. So there has been a dramatic increase over the last decade.
And Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, many of the people enrolled in the GED program are newly arrivals to our country. Many of them are immigrants, and they're at an age of early 20s or older, and so the program will be a good option for them.
Okay. Any other questions? Then can we have a motion for the A3 amendment?
So moved.
Senator Hayden moves the A3 amendment, and I've checked. I think I already asked this, that our staff has reviewed the amendment, probably wrote the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And then Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 410, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Senator Wieger.
Chair, we'd just like to thank Senate Counsel for helping us get the bill in proper form.
All right. Just imagine if we could. Senator Wieger, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Since World War II, up till now, nearly 90,000 Americans, including Minnesotans, are unaccounted for in serving our country. The purpose of Senate File 22 is a resolution addressing POWs, prisoner of war, MIAs, missing in action, and it's a resolution to Congress asking that an independent counsel be formed to investigate this issue. I have testifiers that could not make it, but because of committee deadlines, I wanted to at least share a few of the salient points. But there's several organizations through the American Legion, the VFW, Minnesota Won't Forget POW MIA. There's a national POW MIA director who couldn't make it here from Rochester because of the weather, but there's plenty of support. And one of the great testifiers in the past on this who's left us in the past several months is Stan Kowalski. Some of you may have remembered him as the Crusher, Crusher Kowalski, and he was a decorated vet, former commander, VFW, and he often would testify on this issue and saying, we can never forget. And very briefly, the main points they would make: the U.S. has failed to provide documents to POW, MIA, next of kin, as per federal law. Important unanimous imagery recommendations made in January 1993 final report of the U.S. Senate Select Committee on POW, MIA Affairs have never been implemented. So the focus is on the Defense Prisoner of War Missing Personnel Office. It's through the Department of Defense, and they're asking for greater accountability. In the past, we've had bipartisan support for this. Admittedly, it's a resolution, but we weigh in on it. Many of our communities throughout the state have ceremonies recognizing the POWs, MIAs, and they have, again, reiterated the importance of us going on record.
Any questions for Senator Wieger? Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Wieger, I'm only, by doing this, I'm only assuming that you're saying that they're not investigating this now, or they're not implementing what they're finding out in their investigations. Is that what you're kind of alluding to?
Senator Wieger.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, there are investigations going, but to the military group, the veteran groups, they're saying it's not being done to their satisfaction. And I cited certain documents that are required to be provided to families, imaging documents, and we could get a lot of testimony from groups, but I'm just taking what their testimony would have been if they could have been here. Are they working on it? Yes. Is it adequate? No.
Senator Hall.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Wieger. So you think if we do this, it would be adequate?
Senator Wieger.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, the veteran organizations are making this plea, and on their behalf, I wanted to advance that.
Okay.
Okay. No other questions? Is there a motion?
So moved.
Senator Johnson moves that Senate File 22 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Rules and Administration.
Madam Chair,
Senator,
might
Johnson.
I just say that when Senator Wiger mentioned Stan Kowalski, Stan lived in my district for mm-hmm. the 14 years that I was in the Minnesota House, has been active in the community, in community affairs, as well as in the American Legion and the VFW in Fridley and Spring Lake Park. And so I know that those groups will be very pleased with this bill.
And did you say he passed away recently?
Yes.
Okay. So, in his memory. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wiger. Senator Carlson is on his way. Should we wait for him? He's right here. All right.
Oh, I just know because it's
so bad. Senator Carlson. Senator Carlson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I have Senate File 607. Senate File 607 gives a new authority to the cities. It authorizes a city to establish a municipal street district by adopting an ordinance. It puts the responsibility directly on the cities only. It does not, it is not us that's doing it, it's them. And elected officials still have all the responsibility. And just to make sure I don't miss anything, I have an amendment that we need to adopt, if I could get someone to move it.
It's the A4 amendment passed out. This is your first committee. It'll go to transportation.
It's coming.
Okay. The A4.
While it's being passed out, I can make some descriptions of it. The A4 amendment does some minor updates with some of the stakeholders. We changed a bit of it here to change the status of the unimproved parcels so that land that's not been developed does not get included into the district and is assessed by this transportation district. We also changed a 10-day notification to 30 days. We also put a designation where you cannot put the property in two districts, so there's no overlap, no doubling up. And then there's another moratorium that would be on any district so that any new development wouldn't start paying for their maintenance of the maintenance of other streets for 3 years.
Senator Author's amendment put the bill in the shape he would like it. Senator Eaton moves the A4 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay. Senator, I guess the whole thing's in our jurisdiction, so to describe your bill.
Yes. Well, again, it does authorize a city to take the responsibility themselves. This is probably the maximum of local control. The city has to put together a system to assess these costs, and I shouldn't say that you shouldn't use the word assess, but to collect these costs, and what they would do is put together a fund that would be used for maintenance. And I think we have information that says that the maintenance of streets keeps the streets in better shape when you do it regularly than letting a street deteriorate. You could probably have the life expectancy improve from somewhere between 25 and 30 years to potentially as much as 50 to 60 years. And we have both of my cities in my district, City of Burnsville and the City of Eagan, are in strong support of this. And I'm assuming that we have support from many other cities also, because we have the League of Minnesota Cities that has brought this to us. So, and I have some testifiers here that can give their perspective on it. I have Ms.
Rhonda Pownell
from Northfield, correct? From the City Council of Northfield. And I have Mr. Russ Mathis, who is the city engineer, the public works director in the City of Eagan.
Okay, so before we hear the testimony, are there any questions on the bill? In terms of it allows the city to assess for street improvements.
Madam Chair. Basically.
Senator Hall. Oh, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, we just had something passed out here saying that there's a whole group of organizations, and I've gotten phone calls from the Minnesota Chamber myself opposing this bill. Has the amendment made this any better, that they would support the bill?
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, with the Builders Association, yes. Now, some groups still would oppose it because it does it's like a utility cost where your utilities and your sidewalks are still shared by the class of property because of nonprofits would otherwise not pay property taxes. So there's still some groups that would probably object to it. But again, we are not initiating any costs ourselves from the legislature. It's being initiated by the city, by the mayor and council. So they have to justify to their businesses and their organizations anything that they assess on those properties. So it's not something that we are doing to these organizations. There still is another level of decision that has to be made by the city. And the city has to, Madam Chair, the Senator, the city has to design a system for it. All we're doing is giving them the authorization to design that system.
Madam Chair, I'd like to hear Anderson. Some testimony on both sides if it's possible.
Okay, we will. Mm-hmm. Senator Hall.
Madam Chair, Mr. Carlson, are you telling me that the mayor and city council of Burnsville have approved this?
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair and Senator Hall, yes. I talked with the city manager, Craig Eagling, and he told me, yes, this is in their plan. As a matter of fact, now, when you say they've approved it, they don't know whether they're going to do something like this because they already have a levy fund that they use. They already do a levy. But if this seems to be more fair, they may switch to this. But it's in their legislative agenda to have all the tools necessary to be able to do this. I checked with him just this morning.
Okay, Ms. Pownell.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Councilmember Pownell, welcome.
Yes, thank you, members of the committee. Rhonda Pownell, I've been a Northfield City Council member for 4 years now. Northfield is a vibrant community. We have two top liberal arts colleges. We have a charming downtown, a healthy business sector, and a highly engaged citizenry. It's a community that values the arts, history, and education, but we have some issues. In 2009, we were faced with 18 to 19 miles of roads in poor condition. Two major city facilities that hadn't been maintained, LGA cuts, a coming demographic shift, and declining revenues. We are not unlike many cities across the state. Streets are one of the five main responsibilities at the local level. Northfield has 83 miles of streets. Maintaining and rebuilding those streets has been a high priority for our council. In addition, a 2011 community survey identified streets as our top priority for the community. We have just implemented a new street improvement program to address the ongoing maintenance needs of our streets. However, with 18 to 19 miles of streets in poor condition, we are in need of additional revenue solutions to keep up with a full life cycle rebuilding program. Furthermore, collector streets and changing demographics have posed additional concerns. Northfield currently uses a benefit appraisal to determine assessments. The fairness of this approach has been called into question, especially on our collector streets. In addition, for a couple of our recent projects, a majority of our property owners have been on fixed incomes, which has made handling the assessments difficult. This financing method could be used for special projects like downtown Main Streets or state and county highways that require local shares. While some cities may never use this legislation or use it on a periodic basis, still others may apply it across the board to fund all their street improvement projects. Street improvement districts are a reasonable solution to help cities fund important projects in an equitable manner. This legislation could prove very instrumental in our community in the coming years as more and more property owners turn 65 and are living on fixed incomes. The authority to create districts is not a mandate, but a tool that would be available to us to help fund one of our most important responsibilities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the witness? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Councilwoman. You had mentioned a large number of your constituents feel like streets are a public service that they feel is very important, and that's why we should move on this fee structure, the fee capability. Why can't the council just, I don't know, raise property taxes or use some other kind of revenue source to accomplish that?
Ms. Pano.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think the most important asset of a street improvement district is it alleviates the sticker shock of assessments. We currently assess for all of our street projects, and with more and more of our community getting older and you're considering tax-exempt properties like our churches, I think it would be best to have a fee-based system that could be where you would have smaller fees that could be accumulated over time to fund projects in a timely manner.
Senator Peterson.
Madam Chair, obviously you have some sort of way to identify costs or the ongoing costs of these street repairs. Couldn't you accomplish the same thing by just levying that amount and then that spread out over all of the property tax base? I mean, I understand your point on assessments, but the property tax levy would accomplish those ends as well.
Councilmember Pennell.
I guess I would have to look at, Madam Chair, members, I guess I would have to look at how that would replace assessments, because assessments are really designed to take care of streets that people live on. Businesses are located on, your tax-exempt properties are located on. And so to move to just creating a tax to take care of all those needs would be a big change for our community, and I don't know that that's the best solution. Street improvement districts are just a tool to help us, and creates an ability for us to really look at to see if there is a different option out there that would work best for our community. And with over 850 communities across the state, I think providing different tools is a benefit to all of us, because what works for one city will not work for another.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. The one thing that, having served on a city council for a long time, the one thing that this reminds me of is, like, if you have a water account and you have sewer accounts, so when you pay your water charges, you're paying just a little bit extra to take care of, for instance, painting the water tower and all the maintenance items that come. They're called enterprise accounts, so that when the time comes to paint your water tower, you don't have to all of a sudden jerk the property taxes up that amount. You've got an enterprise account that you've collected. Same with sewers. Most cities, they plan for what has to happen in their sewers in the year. So you have an enterprise account. So when you pay your sewer bill, you're paying just a little bit extra so that when a main line in the city has to be replaced that wouldn't be assessed, there's money for that. You, in most cases, you just don't want to be jerking your property taxes up and down to pay for emergency things that happen or things that you have planned for. And I think that most cities have planned for all of their street overlays or whatever, because they know in time They know in time what has to be done. There's so many years you're going to get out of a bituminous. There's so many years you're going to get out of everything that they do, and they do plan for this. This would just make sure that the money was there when the time came to do a certain project, and you wouldn't have to just jerk up property taxes and trying to figure out a user fee for the non-taxed property. I think it would make it a lot easier for most cities.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Pownell, you did a nice job of describing the community that we both live in. I'm well aware of some of the roads that need fixing as well. But I guess, how do you envision this working in a town like Northfield? Do you see this assessment of the entire city or dividing it up into, you know, a quadrants? And the question I'm really getting at, some concerns have been raised at properties like the colleges that are currently tax-exempt. Do you see do you see Northfield including them in, or would your districts exclude them?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Ms. Pownell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think those very questions are ones that our city council will be asking. This is just creating the opportunity for us to have the discussion. And just for the record, all of our tax-exempt properties in Northfield are currently assessed for street reconstruction projects. And it really would be in the best interest of us as a community in the cost savings if we were to maintain our streets over time versus just relying on reconstruction costs. So it would actually, over time, if our colleges and our tax-exempt properties, if we can convey to them the benefit, right, of not waiting till a reconstruction but actually taking care of our streets over the long haul would be a benefit. I think that would be that's a discussion that needs to happen. And I think certainly we as a community, we value our colleges. We value our tax-exempt properties. And we're stronger together. And I think a lot of the discussion and the decisions that need to be made about those questions, we're going to have to communicate and talk about those to see how this will be formulated.
Thanks.
Then why don't we hear from Mr. Mathis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As the chair just stated, my name is Russ Mathis. I'm the Public Works Director for the City of Eagan, and I'm representing the City Engineers Association of Minnesota today. So thank you for having me this afternoon. Most homeowners appreciate the importance of maintaining their home, their biggest individual investment, whether it's re-caulking windows, repainting the siding, or replacing your shingles. There's a universal understanding of the need to take care of your home if you want it to take care of you. Failure to do so could lead to rotten windowsills, a leaky roof. If left unchecked, the lack of maintenance could eventually lead to the complete deterioration of your home. Similar scenario can play out with the neighborhood street that runs past this home. Comparable maintenance activities such as crack filling, seal coating, and blacktop overlays help maintain a local street in a condition that it may continue to safely and comfortably get you to and from your home. The importance of the proper care of one of a city's biggest investments, or local street system, was recognized 23 years ago in Eagan by establishing a pavement management program. 193 miles of streets have been overlaid or reconstructed over this time period at the cost of $51 million. In addition to the annual maintenance efforts of crack filling and seal coating for another $400,000 per year over this time period. So does the maintenance of the local street system in Eagan really matter to anyone? I'd like to quote the following from a September 24th, 2012 Star Tribune article by David Peterson entitled, "New System Can Evaluate City Performance." Now, from the portion of the article entitled "State of the Roads," data released this month offers a glimpse into key issues such as street conditions, which experts agree is a huge emerging problem as local entities let infrastructure worth hundreds of millions of dollars crumble. At the high end of the scale, Eagan wound up with an off-the-charts level of admiration. 30% of their constituents find their streets to be excellent. And that is a clue to something that's real, said Public Works Director Russ Mathis. Our policy is that there shouldn't be any neighborhoods, any areas, any streets that are less than 45 out of a scale of 100, largely because when they drop to a certain point, they become hugely costly to fix. Eagan surveys its residents every other year to check in with them. A 2010 survey with 95% reliability and results of plus or minus 5% found that 56% rated Eagan street repair and maintenance as good. Take that in combination with a 30% excellent rating. The combined 86% rating of good or excellent has been fairly consistent for about the last decade. And I'd like to mention, not a part of that article, but the recent 2012 survey results were just in, and they were consistent as well. I have a handout I'd like to share with the committee.
Why don't you let him pass it out for you?
The handout demonstrates a typical life cycle of blacktop pavement. I ask that you take note of the rapid rate of degradation between years 15 and 20. That's the cliff, basically, that the chart indicates. We've completed 20-year analysis of the street system within Eagan. We refer to it as our transportation infrastructure needs analysis, and it relates to the Council's selected pavement condition index. The results were telling. The index runs on a scale of 0 to 100, 0 being a basically a non-existent or completely degraded street, where 100 is the score of a new street would actually score. Council's goal is 75. The city needs to spend about $73.7 million over the next 20 years to maintain this goal of 75. Now, the city's current financial plan falls short of funding by more than $1 million annually. As may be expected, in order to attain a higher pavement condition of 80 versus a 75, that is the council's goal, the city would have to increase their costs. So goal of 75 is a cost of $73.7 million. To reach a score of 80, the council would have to spend $74.6 million over the next 20 years. Now, that being so, the city's costs are even greater if the condition is allowed to fall to 70. So whereas a 75 rating for the city costs $73.7 million a year, a score of 70 would actually cost $75.6 million over the 20-year period. And an even lower score of 65 would cost even more for the city at $77.5 million over the 20-year period. The understanding is that the more a street is allowed to deteriorate, the more expensive it is to bring it back to an acceptable level of quality. Now, last year in 2012, we overlaid 21 miles of street at a cost of $6.3 million. Now, we were only able to cover about 13% of that with municipal state aid funds. And of that municipal state aid money that's covering our eligible streets in 2012, we're not going to receive any of that state aid money for another 5 or 6 years because we've spent ahead our state aid allotments 5 to 6 years. Of that, our additional 27% of those costs were covered by special assessments, and then the remaining 60% came from property taxes. Thankfully, we had the property taxes to fund that remaining portion. But that isn't often the situation for cities, and it hasn't been in other Minnesota cities that I've worked. Taking care of our streets is important to all of us. We as cities have tools available to us to help us properly plan and address the care our streets need. The challenge is the age-old one of paying for it. I ask that you provide cities with another funding tool to consider that would help us maintain our streets in a way that benefits all property owners. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay, questions? Sam Peterson, and then Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm still wondering why you had just alluded to the fact that property taxes were used in that case to fund the difference there. I'm just wondering why property tax, general property tax revenue, is not a sufficient tool to fund street improvements. It seems to me like the street improvement fee is really just a property tax by another name. I know it can be applied with more discretion and things like that, but What is stopping municipalities from using the general property tax to pay for these things?
Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, levy limits. Levy limits cap the amount of property taxes that we can levy in the community. Mm-hmm. Egan's very fortunate, in large part because of the large business and industry that we have in the city. We generate more property taxes than most other communities within the state. And so we're able to utilize that additional funding to put more money into our street system. Other communities I've worked in before that are all in the metro area have levied $100,000 worth of street improvements. You can't do very much for $100,000 a year, but that was all that they had available to them as part of the property taxes to expend on street improvements. Another community I've worked for had no property taxes available to them based on the way they set up their budget and based on the levy limits that they had. So the only improvements that we were able to do in that community were improvements that were on state aid streets, which only covers 20% of the streets within this community.
Okay, why don't we bring up, did you have questions for these witnesses?
Yes, just a quick one. My understanding is for general property tax, there isn't a levy limit. Does council have a response to that?
Anybody know about tax stuff?
Madam Chair and Senator Hall, I believe that there are no levy limits currently, but there have been in the past several few years.
So if there's not currently, then that can't be an excuse to just raise that then.
Senator Johnson.
To that point, I read through the scanned through this League of Minnesota Cities handout, and if you look in the fourth paragraph down in the middle of that paragraph, I think it talks about what's happening at cities. Property tax dollars are generally not dedicated and are sometimes diverted to more pressing needs such as public safety, water quality, and cost participation. I think the cities are seeing just as much as we are the need for for revenue to take care of their responsibilities, but are having difficulty when they have to prioritize. And often streets are left to be the last one to be taken care of. And I think it's an example that I can tell you personally about is in the last few years, my husband and I have been wintering in Corpus Christi, Texas. And their streets are really, really bad. And they finally, the city council has finally come up saying that they are being asked their residents to pay, and I believe it was $25 a month, because their streets have deteriorated so badly that everything has to be reconstructed. Again, I don't necessarily.
And they don't have ice.
Pardon me?
They don't have the, you know, the freeze and.
Right. They don't. And it's true. And I'm sure, I mean, they're faced with many needs, too. But it is, I think it will be beneficial to all property owners to have this made available to them.
Okay, Ms. Pawnell, and then we're going to bring up the opposition so we can move along here a little bit more.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I just wanted to say that levy limits, whether or not levy limits are imposed on communities depends on who's in office. That changes, as you know, even as office holders change at the local level, you change at the state level. And so and this tool could be available to cities over the long haul. In addition, property taxes. The percentage our property taxes hit our business community harder than they hit others. Creating this opportunity, a district creates the opportunity to create a formula that is equitable across the board. And it leaves it to the community to be able to have those discussions at the local level with their business community, with their tax-exempt properties, with their residential homeowners. And I appreciate that flexibility.
Madam Chair, I have a question.
Senator Torres Ray. I'm sorry. I forgot you'd
Thank you. Senator Carlson, I support the idea that you're trying to pursue because I have a lot of streets that really need to be fixed badly in my district. So I support the concept. The reason I cannot vote for this bill is the authorization portion. because of the authorization portion and subdivision 2. And let me give you an example of what happens. If this is to pass with the street improvement fees to the parcels located in my district, the main roads that need to be fixed in my districts are Minnehaha Avenue, Cedar Avenue, Hiawatha Avenue, and the River Parkway. They are the worst. And the reason these streets are in such bad shape is because of all the people who come from downtown to suburban communities. They cross my district. And at this time of the day, the River Road Parkway, I cannot go home if I take the River Parkway. And very few of us live along that road in my district. But you cannot drive that road anymore because of all of the downtown business people who are trying to get to Highway 55. The same is true for St. Paul. Shepherd Road, which St. Paul invested a lot in, is a road that at this time of the day you just cannot take. And so these are people the people that live along these roads, particularly for me, along Lake Street. The Lake Street corridor is another one. Cedar Avenue, Minnehaha Avenue, Hiawatha Avenue, and Lake Street, most of the people who live along those corridors are low-income people. And I find it very difficult for me to support a formula through which not only they are paying very high property taxes right now to maintain those roads, but they will be paying for a fee for a road that they cannot use because they have to take alternative roads to get home because a lot of the people who are coming through that road actually don't live in those communities. So I do see the need to repair those roads. My community is desperately for repairing those roads that I'm mentioning to you. But I do need to have some stipulation here that actually incorporates some language that is for the users of these roads, not for the people who actually live along these corridors, because this will be very the impact for these homes will be very significant. So I want you to know that I happen to have a small district that has a lot of these main roads for whom this is very problematic.
While you're thinking about that, let's bring up the other two testifiers, Mr. Milner and Ms. Fox. And Senator Thompson, did you have a comment or question for Senator Carlson?
Actually, Madam Chair, I have an amendment that I would have waited until everybody's done, but in light of Senator Torres-Ray's comments, it seems relevant. Do you want it now, or would you prefer that I wait till everybody's
done? Let's hear from the witnesses, and then we'll be sure to take
your
amendment.
That's fine, Madam Chair. Thank you.
I think both Ms. Fox and Mr. Milner could come up.
Madam Chair.
Senator Carlson.
While the new testifiers are coming in here, one of the things, Senator Torres-Ray, is that you're speaking of the state aid roads. Those have different funding than the city streets. So it's the city streets is what we're speaking of here.
Are all those roads you talked about state aid?
I don't know.
It could
chair.
Be.
Just, you know,
Cedar
is
a main road. People in the audience are nodding and think those are state aid roads.
Yeah.
So we need to beef up the municipal state aid pot.
Yeah.
That's,
we need
that's
to
where we
that.
Need the money from. Yeah. But that's a good point, that we do have a statewide formula for these more frequented roads that other people outside your local community use, and that to try to meet that issue of equality. Okay, Mr. Milner.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Jacob Milner, and I'm with the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association, and I'm here to speak in opposition to Senate File 607. There are over 20 organizations, which you should all have in front of you, ranging from nonprofits to faith organizations to businesses and business associations opposed to this bill for several reasons. And I think it's important that we all take a minute and look at the list there to really understand the depth and the breadth of the opposition to this proposal. And I have a few other colleagues that will give some more in-depth testimony as well. But our first concern is that this bill gives broad authority to municipalities to increase taxes for transportation improvement projects. We believe there already exist several taxing mechanisms available at the municipal level to that allow them to raise revenue for transportation projects. And on the one pager you should have, we've listed six or seven of those options that already exist right now, which cities are using. Under this proposal, there is no need, and this is a grave concern to us, for a city to prove a benefit to the affected property to justify imposing the new fee. It is conceivable under this legislation that your property could be located within the taxing district but not be located near the road improvement or get any benefit from that improvement project which you're paying for. Nonetheless, the city could still impose a tax on the property to finance it. Additionally, cities under this legislation are free to draw a taxing district in any shape or size, which allows them to impose the tax on only certain properties, and this is fundamentally unfair to those located within the taxing district and those located outside the taxing district. Nothing would prohibit a city from imposing the street improvement fee in such a way which minimally affects homeowners in this instance and burden commercial property owners instead, who might not be voting members of the community. There is seemingly no limit, according to this legislation, on how the system could be devised. The street improvement fees authorized also in this bill also do not sunset after a particular project has been paid for. Once, rather, imposed, the fee can be collected from property owners for up to 20 years and can presumably be renewed for 20 years after that. And that's also a concern for us because 20 years down the line is just – it's so far out in the future that we can't even really – it seems – the length of that is just – it's too much for us. And finally, the property owners in every district are already paying for street improvement projects through property taxes, levies, and other taxing mechanisms. For all those reasons and others, and again, you'll hear from a few other of my colleagues shortly, I encourage you to reject this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Fox.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Just a short word about the Council of Nonprofits. We are an association of 2,000 organizations, nonprofit organizations around the state and in every area of charitable activity. And today we are standing with the most diverse coalition the Council of Nonprofits has ever been involved with. And I, as Jacob said, I do agree. I think that is significant to see a list, everything from the Girl Scouts to the Y's to your nursing homes, from private industry, all sharing some of the same concerns, and I have a couple extra ones on behalf of the nonprofit sector. Our main concerns are, one, that it's too broad in scope and the amount of authority given. With all due respect to the councilwoman, I don't think it would provide for much of a discussion. As you can see, the governing body would allow for comment, and then they get to vote, and the public does not. We think it goes too unchecked for too long, up to 20 years on projects, and certainly goes too far in the minds of the tax-exempt sector. And we feel that it indeed violates the principle and history of constitutionally protected tax-exempt status of C3 organizations, organizations purely public charity, and others. And we have certainly seen, our members have seen a proliferation of fees around the state in various cities, and this one goes way far beyond anything we've seen so far, which has most typically been street lighting. And the Minnesota legislature has continually reexamined the criteria for tax exemption on property tax for nonprofits, most recently in 2009 with your colleagues, Senator Bach, Representative Marquardt in the House. We do, of course, like all good citizens, support increased improvements and infrastructure. We think there are many tools cities have to do that, and probably most known are the special assessments, which nonprofits actually pay, always have, always will, but benefit is demonstrated in an actual improvement to the property. We would not argue that. And as has been brought up, the existing property tax system. So I would encourage you on behalf of all our nonprofit organizations to vote no against this bill. Thank you.
I'm sorry, I have to announce that Mr. Stan Kowalski is alive and well. Oh. So don't send him any condolence cards. Oh. I don't know why we thought he had passed away, or Senator Wieger thought. But anyway, he called Senator Wigger to commend him on passing that bill.
But he has not passed.
Madam Chair, as I said in the note, he's not an easy. He doesn't take a fall very easily.
Right.
The crusher.
I apologize. Ms. Fox, were you complete?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please introduce yourself for
Madam Chair, thank you, members. My name is Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. I apologize for not submitting my name in advance, and I will not try to not repeat what has already been said. We also oppose the bill. One of the proponents of the bill mentioned that businesses pay a lot in property taxes, and she's right, and that's one of our concerns about this, is that we see this as a third property tax. Businesses obviously pay local property taxes like all other properties, like homes, apartments. But business property is unique in that it also pays a statewide business property tax. About $820 million a year is what it is right now. And our concern is that this new, we see it as a tax, would be a third property tax. And our largest concern is that there is nothing in this bill that gives us any comfort as to how that tax would be imposed. At least with the property tax classification rate, we know we pay a higher rate than other properties. But under this proposal, there is no assurance whatsoever that we wouldn't pay for, you know, 99% of the new fee. So that's a concern. Also, there was a bill that this committee passed out of a committee just last week. It was Senator Saxhog's bill that expanded the definition for street reconstruction, right, that allows cities to do bonding, mm-hmm, for street reconstruction. And there's also some taxpayer protections in that law that that if a majority of the voters don't want it, you can go back to a vote. Mm-hmm. And that bill was expanded last week to include blacktop overlays. So that's a street maintenance bill. We didn't oppose that. I think that is a mechanism that we feel is fairer because it's spread over more people, it's bonded, it's a long-term approach. So I guess that's another reason why we're not sure why this is another way to pay for streets when we already have street, the special assessments, special service districts. And so we would move your opposition. Thank you.
Any other discussion? Anyone else in the room that wants to testify? Favor or against? Okay, Ms. Finn. Thank you both very much. Very interesting coalition. A lot of friends to make mad here.
Madam Chair and members, right, my name is Finn. Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. And I did want to just clarify that what you just heard is that tax-exempt properties currently pay special assessments. That is a fact. This tool would be an alternative to special assessments, and we think that it might actually be something that a nonprofit organization could more easily absorb as a part of their budget because it's an ongoing fee rather than the big reconstruction assessment that they face under current law. The other point I wanted to make is that street improvement fees are deductible for tax purposes. We have vetted that through House Counsel. And right now, special assessments are not. And so we think that's another advantage for a city that might want to consider using a street improvement fee.
Senator Carlson or any of the witnesses, on page 2, subdivision 3, line 2.9, uniformity, is there a reason for that uniformity section to be in there? Is that... Seems like you might have streets that have heavier traffic, and there might, and some that have less traffic. That, you know, the heavier traffic streets might, because there are trucks coming in and out of a business, might maybe have more street improvement needs, and others might not.
Madam Chair, I'll let Mr. Mathis address that issue, but I would say that this sort of gets at the issue that Senator Torres-Ray brought up, in that just because you live on a busier street, a collector shouldn't mean that necessarily you should be paying more. Mm. The uniformity provision is to get at the idea that a single-family home should all pay the same, and that like businesses should all pay the same based on their zoning. So we would anticipate that that would give the city the flexibility to make sure that it's as fair as possible.
Madam Chair?
Who said Madam Chair?
I didn't.
Mr. Mathis.
Okay, thank you. I think what they're trying to get to, I'll give you an example of how things are done in Eagan. If it's an assessment, well, I'll talk about special assessments. If the special assessments are being levied on residential properties, single-family residential properties, those assessments are only 50% of the cost of the bituminous pavement. Understanding that the residential users are going to use the streets as well as visitors, neighbors, other people driving through the neighborhood. When we're in a industrial or commercial area, most of the people driving on those streets either are providing trucking services to those businesses, so it's a part of the business of the property owners in there, or else they're customers of those businesses. The reason that streets are being used in those industrial and commercial areas is because of what's in that industrial commercial area. So I think that's the purpose of, apportioning this, uniformity within the classification of real estate. So properties within a commercial industrial area are going to be similar types of properties, but they're different and unique from residential type properties. And the use and even the size of the vehicle and the number of vehicles related to the businesses versus the residential units are going to be significantly different.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to point out one thing about the commentary from the League of Minnesota Cities as it relates to nonprofits. You mentioned that they do pay assessments. I think that's actually significant as it relates to this bill because one of the problems that I have with the bill is that the people who pay the fee don't necessarily derive any benefit from the fee itself or from the collection or the fund or the street improvement fund or whatever they call it. And in that case, and in an assessment, the nonprofit does actually directly benefit from the assessment. I think that's the difference here. And whereas now we're talking about general taxation of nonprofits across the board, regardless of benefit. So I think it's just an important point to make.
Senator Peterson, I think it's a little bit of a hybrid because if you look on page 2.27, subdivision 6, it does say that the revenue must be placed in a separate account and used only for projects located within the district and identified in the municipal street improvement plan. So the assessment is very high right in that immediate area. So I think the witnesses argued that having it in the street improvement plan, it will get to your street eventually, but you're going to be paying for it over a 20-year period rather than all at once. But you would be in the improvement plan. Senator Peterson.
To that point,
is that
though,
my understanding?
Madam Chair, there's no restriction from the municipality from making the entire city necessarily a street improvement district. And so there isn't necessarily a direct benefit as there is in an assessment to a nonprofit. Just because the street improvement plan or street improvement fee monies go into an account dedicated to the district could comprise the entire city if that's the discretion of the ordinance.
Well, Senator Carlson, I see that in your amendment you deleted the Subdivision 5 citywide districts. So does that mean that you couldn't do what Senator Peterson is concerned about? Ms. Finn.
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, there's nothing in here that prohibits the city from doing it citywide. And we suspect that in talking with our engineers and elected officials that for some cities it would make more sense to do it citywide. We have the city of Sleepy Eye, for example, that is really hoping this gets done. And they think that if they were able to implement it, they would do something citywide.
Okay.
The other point I wanted to make with you is that on the special assessments, cities have really found that in recent years they're ending up in litigation over the benefit test. And so we have cities that have spent tens of thousands of dollars in court trying to make sure that the benefit test sticks. And residents are and businesses in some cases are winning that if there was a street there before and there's a street there afterwards, the benefit test doesn't work. Because it doesn't improve the benefit or the value of the property as much as the city says it might.
Well, I. I'm sorry. Oh, Senator Thompson. Senator Dahl.
Right. Madam Chair, and again, as I consider this particular bill, I'm going to be supporting it because of, again, this is enabling. And I would hope that our communities with the car dealerships, the colleges, the business folks would decide, is this the best tool for their particular city? And that's going to change depending on where you go. I've gotten three mayor phone calls today that say this is the kind of tool that they want in their particular city. So I would hope that this fear of these 30 things that could go wrong would be addressed by the local governments that are going to put in place what they feel is the best for their particular community, especially if all those local community members can agree to it. So I think it's a good tool.
Senator Thompson, should we pass out your amendment now?
Yes, please. Thank you, Madam Chair. It is the A5 amendment, and let me just describe briefly. It's quite simple. It would allow the citizens that are subject to one of these improvement districts to submit a petition and require a referendum. So essentially, and it, I had counsel take it from language that is commonly in state law. I believe that'd be a fair way to say it. Is that right?
Madam Chair and Senator Thompson, this is same process, same numbers, but slightly tweaked as subordinate service districts for towns and cities.
Thank you. And so, Madam Chair, I would move this amendment. It seems to me, and I'm not really passing judgment on this, but it seems to me that there's an attempt here to find a way to get a tax assessed more easily. Mm-hmm. And I think Senator Peterson's comments should be taken note of with respect to the application to 501c3s, to nonprofits, because having fees assessed that directly benefit them is different than the tax concept with a more kind of generalized benefit. But I think at the very least there should be the backstop that if you can get a sufficient number of citizens to sign a petition and say, wait a minute, I think the people ought to get a vote on this. I think that's a reasonable protection against this sort of thing being done when the people don't want it done. So I would move the A5 amendment, Madam Chair, and request a roll call.
Senator Carlson, your feelings on the A5?
Well, Madam Chair, I would oppose the A5 amendment. We don't do referendums for sewer charges, for water charges, for sidewalks. And we already have an elected mayor and council that is accountable and responsible for this. This is done through the city council. The city council has to design the system. And so it's merely authorization from us. And I think putting the extra burden of a referendum on there is unneeded.
I sense a little discomfort with this bill, and I'm just wondering if the referendum would help or not make a difference. Senator Thompson, no comments?
Madam Chair, I mean, I would hope it would make a difference, and I appreciate you raising that, in that it gives somewhat, as I say, of a backstop if a large percentage of the population is concerned about it. And to Senator Carlson's point, when we do things like put in water and sewer lines and those kinds of things, those are typically assessed as fees, oftentimes in a municipality. They'll be part of the development costs for a developer that comes in to do things. And that truly is more of a fee concept. If I move into a development with 100 houses and the presumed cost is, you know, $13,000, $15,000 to get these things run into my property, that's what I'm going to be hit with. So that is more of a fee. This truly acts like a tax, and frankly, for an awful lot of local taxes, we do use the referendum. So once again, I don't think the people ought to be taken out of this equation.
Any other comments on the amendment? Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, for me, the issue, the problematic issue with this is that you heard Senator Thompson when it comes to funding and figuring out, you know, whose responsibility is to do this. It's nobody's responsibility. So we have, you know, now the nonprofits, the auto association. Every time we talk about, you know, who has some responsibility into, you know, paying for these services that are important to all of us in a community. Every time you pose the question, nobody does. Nobody comes forward. And these campaigns that we have to do locally, in order to pass these referendums have become so incredibly expensive because we are not able to make those decisions here. And I feel that, you know, I'm glad that you clarify the whole issue on what streets are you talking about, and that it's very important to me. I think that, you know, when it comes to infrastructure and schools, we do this a lot. We ask local communities to go on a campaign and raise a lot of money to take care of fundamental needs in our communities. And I think that's mainly the problem that I have with this, that I think that we are responsible for figuring out. And, yes, there are some organizations that are going to be upset about paying for these fees, but we do need to build our infrastructure, take care of it, and we need to educate our kids. No question about that. We don't need, you know, this whole issue of raising now millions of dollars to pass referendums is just wrong. So that's kind of my fundamental opposition to this referendum campaign.
Any other comments on the amendment? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the amendment, I think it's significant to note that it also is structured here as a reverse referendum. So we're not necessarily suggesting that they need to put it to a referendum right away. This gives just some method to organize for the people who live in that city if there is enough passion to change the ordinance after the fact. So we are granting the authority to the municipality up front, and we're saying if there is a groundswell of citizen opposition to this policy, then we can invoke a reverse referendum. I think that's an important point to make here. We're not talking about a straight-up referendum on the issue. I also like referendum because, again, this is a bill that has sweeping authority, really, to structure the district however they want, to apply it to the types of parcels in zoning completely at their discretion. And it could affect potentially every single resident in the city. So to give the citizens at least a mechanism to change that, I don't think is necessarily something we should be afraid of.
Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair and members, I would not support this amendment. I'm thinking of, the city of Spring Lake Park, 7,000 people. We could probably get 25% of the voters quite easily if there were somebody heading up a movement. But take a look at something like Minneapolis, St. Paul, Bloomington, Blaine. That would be a very expensive undertaking, I would believe, to, first of all, to inform the voters about what this is all about. And they elect people we all elect our city councils to make the decisions for our cities. So it's very appropriate if one of our cities, one of my cities, Coon Rapids, Blaine, and Spring Lake Park, decides to do it, they're going to be facing the voters if the voters think it's very, very wrong. They will also be, I would guess, inundated with visitors to the city council meetings and so forth. There are ways for local people to make their likes known. I think it would be a really expensive proposition that I don't think is necessary when we have elected members of the city council making decisions for us.
Okay. Any other comments, Senator Carlson?
Yeah. Madam Chair and members, I might add that sometimes a referendum, we do have representative government, and sometimes a referendum leaves people out. And that's the business community that you've heard testify here. The business community would not be voting in that referendum. And I think the mayor and council has had to have been elected to balance the business community with the residents. And so sometimes they might have to take a hard vote that is for the business community. And I would expect that they all support making sure their business community is happy so that they don't leave.
Any more discussion on the amendment? Senator Hall.
And Senator, if you look at the sheet here, it looks like the business community, including the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, is against this. So I'm not sure using the business community would be the best venue to go with.
Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair, no more argumentation, just a clarification. Mm-hmm. It's actually, if you look at the, I thank you for counsel for pointing this out to me, I forgot to mention it, that it's actually not the entire population within this particular district. It's 25% of the property owners, so it's the people directly affected by the assessment.
Okay. Okay, the secretary will take the roll on the A5 amendment.
Pappas?
No.
Somebody who wasn't a resident.
Eaton?
No.
Hall?
Yes.
Anderson?
Yes.
Dahl?
No.
Hayden? Housley?
Yes.
Johnson?
No.
Peterson?
Yes.
Scalzi?
No.
Thompson?
Yes.
Torres Ray?
No.
Wicklund?
No.
There being 5 in favor and 7 opposed, the amendment does not prevail. Anything, any other amendments, any other comments on the bill?
I'll give a
comment. Senator Hall.
I'm just kind of a regular guy here, but it seems like we have ways of paying for these things, and you can call it a funding tool. I would call it a taxing tool, that another one that people would have a hard time understanding. And I just can't imagine we need to me, it's another gimmick to try to get more taxes. I don't think the cities would really want it a gimmick, although I'm hearing they do. I'm surprised at that because I don't think it's as transparent as it should be. And without a referendum, I would encourage a no vote.
Members, just so you know, this bill would, if it passes, go to transportation, and then I assume the tax committee, too. So it still has a long way to go. Sam Peterson, did you raise your hand?
No.
No? Okay. Any other discussion?
Did we request a roll call?
Roll call, no. Roll call has been requested. Is there a motion?
I'll move it.
Senator Johnson moves that Senate file 607, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Transportation. The secretary will take the roll.
Pappas?
Yes.
Eaton?
Yes.
Hall?
No.
Anderson?
No.
Dahl?
Yes.
Hayden? Housley?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Peterson?
No.
Scalzi?
Yes.
Thompson?
No.
Torres Ray?
Yes.
Wicklund?
Yes.
Can a vote of 7-5, the motion does prevail and the bill is passed and sent to the Transportation Committee. Okay, the next bill on the agenda is Senate File 515, Senator Scalzi. And Senator Eaton, if you would just chair for a minute.
Senator Scalzi, which bill were you doing first?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. We're looking at Senate File 515.
Okay.
From the Met Council, and you have in your packet a piece of paper that looks like this. Hopefully this is not as controversial as the last bill. You have two of these, so you have to look at just a little bit above the bar here, and the 515 will be on one of those.
It's not there.
Do you have an amendment?
No, Madam Chair, we don't. Did you find, just so, yeah, they are in the packets. Okay, thank you. I don't know if this bill, Senate File 515, is to extend the sunset date for the Metro Water Supply Advisory Committee for 4 years until the end of 2016. And I don't know if some of you have followed just recently the St. Paul Pioneer Press has been putting in a lot of articles about water supply. And I've questioned that here myself because we don't always know what the water supply is, but I do know that I'm contacted by this advisory committee, and they tell me what's happening out there, and I think they've done a really good job in the past. So with me here today, just for this bill, that would just extend the deadline. The deadline is currently 2012, and this would make it retroactive to December. and extend the deadline to December 31st of 2016. I have with me here today Judge Shetnan from the Met Council and also Keith Buttleman from the Met Council staff.
Proceed.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, my name is Judd Shetnan. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. I appreciate the opportunity to be here before you, and I appreciate Senator Scalzi for carrying this bill. As she mentioned, this is an agency initiative, and what we are seeking here is to extend our sunset date. It actually expired last December. We weren't sure if we were going to pursue the extension. After thinking about it, we decided since there are state agencies and communities that participate as part of our work, and that water does not necessarily have municipal boundaries like municipalities, cities, counties, townships, that we thought it would be great to bring this this back, all for the reasons that that Senator Scalzi mentioned, is that we are looking at a comprehensive review of what water issues, water supply issues the region has. And with me is Keith Buttleman, who is our director of water quality issues at the Metropolitan Council, and he can speak to any specific questions you have. But we believe that this is a non-controversial bill and have received very good support on this bill in the past. So thank you.
Thank you. Were you going to comment?
Madam Chair and members, my name is Keith Buttleman, Assistant General Manager.
Did you say your last name? I just didn't catch it.
Buttleman.
Buttleman.
Yes.
Thank you.
Assistant General Manager for Environmental Quality Assurance at the Metropolitan Council Environmental Services. And part of my responsibility is the water supply planning function that the legislature gave to the Metropolitan Council back in 2005. We have found that the advisory committee that was set up with that legislation has been extremely helpful. It's composed of mayors, city council members, public utility managers, as well as state agency representatives from all seven counties in the metro area. And in 2010, excuse me, four northern tier counties were added to that because, as Judd just mentioned, the water supply doesn't recognize metro area boundaries any more than county or city boundaries. Like I said, the committee has been very helpful in developing our plans and programs, and provides good representation of local interests in this important subject matter.
Okay, are there any questions? Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shetnan, you said you were thinking about not continuing it. Why were you thinking about not continuing it?
Mr. Shetnan.
Madam Chair, Senator, the council has the authority under the council's jurisdiction to proceed with this. But as Mr. Buttleman just mentioned and what's in our handout is that we, in the previous legislation where we extended this, there was legislation added that added the collar counties. And we felt that oftentimes when the Met Council comes to the legislature that people will give – we don't want to give the impression that we are operating outside of our jurisdictional boundaries. So we figured it would be best to come back before the legislature and put it in statute. And also because – as Mr. Buttleman mentioned, we also deal with state agencies, and so putting it in statute and making sure that the legislature and the folks who serve on this committee realize that we have a vision that goes beyond the seven-county metro area, we felt that that would be the best approach rather than the council just convening this ourselves.
Okay, any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shetnan, what kind of reports have come forth from the advisory committee as far as the concerns that you deal with?
Mr. Shetnan.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I'm going to turn that over to Mr. Buttleman and let him speak to that. It has been very comprehensive.
Mr. Buttleman.
Madam Chair and members, the primary report or document that has come out of this is a master plan for water supply for the metro area. And that is required to be updated every 5 years, and we are in the process of updating that as research provides more and more information about the situation of water supply, particularly the declining groundwater levels within the metro area. In addition to that, there have been a number of reports on conservation mechanisms, on pricing structures, on water reuse from stormwater or wastewater reuse for various non-potable uses in communities as a way of extending existing water supplies. And lots of research about the kinds of problems that some communities are facing now where they're seeing water levels declining dramatically over the last several decades.
Madam Chair?
Senator Anderson.
As the Met Council, I'm gathering Met Council because White Bear Lake is part of the and probably part of Senator Scalzi's area. Have they come up with a solution for the White Bear Lake scenario there?
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Anderson, it's not in my district, but a lot of the Northern Lakes are draining much the same way that, or draining or not draining, whatever the report comes back to tell us. But they're all experiencing lower levels, and there is a lawsuit currently against the DNR by some people in White Bear Lake because it's the DNR that grants the permits mm-hmm. for taking out water. So there's lots of things happening, and I think that, like some people say, in the future, the wars won't be over oil. It's going to be over water. This is something we've been looking at for years, and it's just now coming to a head with the White Bear Lake issue, and I think we all have to look at it very seriously.
Senator Scalzi or Mr. Buttleman, who's taking water out of White Bear Lake?
Madam Chair and members, it's all of us. All of the communities in the white in the vicinity
water?
In northern yes, drinking water. Aquifers have declined in some areas as much as 1 foot a year over the last couple of decades.
Well, good thing we get our water from the Mississippi in St. Paul. No, we have aquifers. That's right. We have aquifer water.
And, Madam Chair, that's one of the options that people are talking about is maybe using more Mississippi River water mm-hmm. and not so much pumping because White Bear Lake, it's presumed that it's leaking out the bottom and that it, for some reason it's the level is going down mm-hmm. because the aquifer is possibly being depleted. But the studies aren't conclusive yet.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Scalzi?
Yes, Madam Chair and members, I would move Senate File 515 to be passed and go to the floor.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And your other bill, Senate File 551.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senate File 551, which is on the same kind of black and white sheet like this. This is a Metropolitan Council housekeeping change bill, and so it just makes technical corrections to statutes and removes and modifies obsolete statutory language related to Met Council's wastewater treatment services. So here with me is Judge Shetnan and also Jason Willett.
No, that's fine. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, I'm Judge Shetnan with the Metropolitan Council. What we have before you is another agency bill. We view this as a housekeeping technical bill. What we are really trying to do here is clean up obsolete statute. A number of these relate to references in statute that we are just trying to clean up. And with me is Jason Willett, who's our finance director for our wastewater utility. And he is able to walk through these with you. Also on the handout, we go through piece by piece and explain what each of the technical corrections we're making. So I'd appreciate your support, and Mr. Willett can answer any questions.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Willett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I'm Jason Willett. I'm a director of the MCS Division of Metropolitan Council of the Wastewater Utility in the finance and energy area. I'm going to try to go through this very quickly, but would be happy to entertain more questions if you want them. Section 1, we're just eliminating the words target pollution loads. That's redundant. The PCA does that activity. We don't really need to do that. Section 2, 4, and 8 are just editorial. These are from the days when we were called the Metropolitan Waste Control Commission. We're just trying to clean up that language. Section 3 is a little bit broader than that. It it authorizes explicitly for us to allow the cities to pay their volume charges in the sewer system. We serve 107 cities now, to allow them to pay that over time only if and when they request it. We did have the city of Maple Plain ask us to do that last year, and while we might be able under intergovernmental agreements, this would make it clear that if cities want that, because sometimes their bills do bounce around a little bit based on their measured flow of wastewater, that we would be permitted to do that. We would charge them interest, so it wouldn't really cost anybody else. It would just be a convenience for the city that wanted it. Section 5 actually is just trying to eliminate some old bureaucracy. We used to get direct federal grants for wastewater capital costs up to 87. So we haven't got those in 25 years. The feds require that we look at the local government's user charge system. Very frankly, we don't want to. So we'd like to eliminate this unless the feds made us do it again. We just as soon let the cities do their own business. Section 6, again, just editorial. That goes back even further to the regional sewer board when we're trying to clean that up. Section 7, there's another waste control language editorial fix, but also more importantly, there's language in there that says that if there were an emergency, we could issue emergency certificates, which we'd like to retain the authority to do that, even though we never have. It says if we did do that, we shall levy a tax. All of our bonds are paid for out of user fees. We would like to make that permissive rather than mandatory. That allow us, if we ever did use that provision, to still issue general obligation bonds and still charge our users through user fees. If you were to levy a tax, you'd actually hit some people that we don't serve in a different proportion, and we don't really want to do that, never have. Let's see, and I'm down to Section 9. This is even more of an obsolete. There's reference there to a session law from 1984, and if you go to the reviser's website and click on that, it says it's repealed. Mm-hmm. It's not really repealed, so we're just trying to make it reference the statutes that it refers to, so someone that was trying to follow the chain there could actually figure that out. Madam Chair, that's all that this bill is.
Are there
is.
Any questions? Okay, seeing none, Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I would move Senate File 551 to be passed and sent to the floor.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you so much.
Senator Hall, would you chair, please?
That was great. Yep.
Be glad.
I had to wait.
Yes, exactly.
I like when he chairs for my job.
That's great.
Senator Pappas, you have Senate File 1190.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 1190 is a housekeeping bill for the Legislative Coordinating Commission. And since Mr. Hubinger has been sitting here for an hour and a half, I'm going to let him explain the bill. And we do have an A1 amendment.
Okay, there's an A1 amendment.
I'll offer the A1 author's amendment.
The A1 author's amendment is being offered and moved. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed the same. The A1 amendment is moved and approved. Senator.
I'm going to let Mr. Hubinger,
Hubinger,
since he's been sitting here for so long.
Identify yourself and proceed. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. This is another housekeeping bill before you. I'll quickly run through the sections. Section 1 clarifies that the chair of the Legislative Advisory Commission rotates each 2 years between the House and the Senate. Section 2 clarifies that the LCC can accept gifts and grants. Sections 3 and 4 relate to the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement and how they handle expenses of that commission. Sections 5, 6, and 7 relate to the Compensation Council, basically aligning up the dates that relate to that council to the dates in which the year the council does its work and makes its recommendations to the legislature. Section 8 eliminates a provision in the Mississippi River Parkway Commission that allows it to subpoena witnesses. We believe it's never been used. Section 9 is an uncodified section that provides for the LAC chair to be from the Senate in 2013. Section 10 repeals two provisions, one relating to an Office of Legislative Research in the legislature that hasn't been used in 25 years, and Section 3.855, a repealer that relates to the Legislative Advisory Commission, or excuse me, the Subcommittee on Government Accountability, which has not met in 3 years.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Huebinger. Are there any questions by members to Senator Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Huebinger, on Section 4, you're deleting the expenses shall be paid, that language there. What is that already in statute, that how the your who's going to be paying the expenses for the commission?
Mr. Huebinger.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, the language continues that provides for the commission to approve expenses that are to be paid, but instead of referring to a generic state, they would be following the LCC's policies that apply to all of the joint legislative offices.
Mr. Chair Anderson.
And Mr. Huebinger, and what is that? What does that say, your rules?
Mr. Huebinger.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, all expenses are approved by that are within the scope of that commission. Expenses, reimbursements of per diems and travel expenses for that commission, expenses for their actuary are approved by the director, by the chair of that commission, and by the chair of the LCC before they're paid.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Huebinger, and they're paid by the legislature?
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, yes, there's an appropriation to the LCC for all of the operations of all the joint offices.
Mr. Chairman, maybe Mr. Huebinger can explain to the committee exactly what the LCC is, because I don't think we've had you before us before.
Mr. Huebinger.
Mr. Chair and members, the Legislative Coordinating Commission is a joint House-Senate commission made up of 12 members, 6 from the Senate and 6 from the House, primarily the leadership from both bodies. They provide oversight and are responsible for all of the operations of the joint legislative offices. In the state government finance bill is an appropriation to the LCC that that supports all of the joint legislative functions.
Right. Give some examples.
The general fund appropriation to the LCC is about...
I mean the commissions that you... LCC.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Huebinger.
There is the commission, Legislative Coordinating Commission, the Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources, the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement, the Mississippi River Parkway Commission. That's an example, sure. Most of them.
You do the regent.
Any other questions by members? Seeing none, Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate File 1190 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor.
All in favor of that movement?
Hold on.
Say aye.
Hold on.
Wait.
Because the gifts and grants are appropriated to the LCC.
Finance. Okay. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, has to go to finance. So I'll move that Senate File 1190 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee.
Moved.
One second.
Yes. Finance Committee says they don't need to see it.
They don't usually tell us, okay. Do they?
I checked with them.
Oh, you checked with them. Oh, all right. Then we're back to the original motion sent to the floor.
Okay. Senator Pappas renews her motion for 1190 as amendment to move to the floor. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Bill does pass.
And, Mr. Chairman, you can adjourn the committee.
We will. Without any further business, this committee is adjourned.